Kildare Today with Clem, Owen and Kira.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Thanks, Kira. Welcome back. And by the way, we were talking about teachers, we were talking about parents. What about the students in all of this? And indeed, Kira just drew my attention, an article that's in The Nationalist in regards to post-primary pupils Hannah Robinson and James Bollard, who are student union representatives in Kildare. They issued a statement strongly criticising the move to reopen schools. And Hannah is quoted as saying, "I believe that the government message to schools was last minute and not the best decision for students' education and well-being. With the high numbers of close contacts and infections, there's a huge amount of concern and confusion about whether classes will be even going to go ahead." Well, we heard from our principals there, as definitely there's a staggered return happening in the schools. Not all classes will be back, and in some cases, classes are going to be sent home. That's got implications for parents' homes where both parents are working. And also we're hearing today a lot of creches are remaining closed as well. So we might talk to Early Childhood Ireland on that tomorrow, on the impact of the return to as people go back to work. Is creche space available? Are they open? We're hearing reports that many creches are not reopening at present due to concerns over the COVID surge. Another student, James Bollard, who's a transition year student, said that the numerous waves of the pandemic, his belief is that the government's decision to bring students and staff back to in-person education is too early. He says, "My position is that priority should be given to exam year students and students with special needs. A staggered return will enable exam year students to get the priority they deserve in the event of large-scale teacher absences." And that point actually, interestingly, made by Jill in the WhatsApp message that she sent to us a couple of minutes ago. I actually referred to that, where she said, "Difficult times for these students, particularly the sixth years, whose education has been so disrupted over the 2 years. They should be offered the option of accredited grades as well." Keep your messages coming. "Good morning, Clem," says Sean. "Omara, what seems to be coming through by teachers' unions is that they do not want to go back to work. All through this pandemic, they complained for a variety of reasons. Many times they spoke about industrial actions and were not quiet either when they were looking for a pandemic bonus. Schools are best places for children, and the mental health of the children is more important than a couple of teachers. If 10% of people are not vaccinated, it is probably the same for teachers. Is this the real reason 15% are absent? Teachers say we are getting bashed, but they bring it upon themselves," says Sean. Well, Sean, in fairness now, not one of our four speakers this morning, the two trade union presidents, INTO-STI, are our two principals, said for a moment, or implied for a moment, they don't want to be back in school. They spoke exclusively about wanting their schools to be open and to be safe places. Florrie Kenny says, "With certain Leaving Cert classes returning in some schools and not others due to resource shortages, how is this leaving all Leaving Cert students on a par and equal footing for the exams ahead this year? My son returned today and his first three classes were cancelled due to the teacher not being in. I think," says Florrie Kenny, "that the government and Norma Foley covering themselves, saying that they managed to keep the schools open in Ireland, but have not left all students on equal footing where state exams are concerned." And indeed, keep your views in regards coming in regards to that. A couple of other messages to catch up on. In regards to the Corrie camp being an eyesore, 43 derelict buildings yesterday, we interviewed the president of PD4, Mark Keane, and Seamus says, "Is it not ironic that officials in the Department of Foreign Affairs were having champagne parties after we won a seat at the UN, when realistically that seat was achieved by the dedicated service of Irish troops over 60 years to peacekeeping around the world?" What else have we got? Joy says that Norma Foley is arrogant in her attitude. Another listener says, "What planet, Mary says, is the Minister for Education living on? Principals are out on their own, still waiting on help from the department, contrary to what the minister has said." Connor Winkle says, "Norma Foley is engaging in terminological inexactitudes. Let's use the term that Winston Churchill once used in the Houses of Westminster. When she says schools are safe, in other countries, schools have been closed and moved to remote learning, even when they've already had additional measures like HEPA filters and FFP2 masks for all children. This government will be directly responsible, says Conor Winkle, for the mass infection of children with Omicron, including children who are already infected with Delta, as well as school staff and all of their families. No plans have been made by the department in the last 2 years to enable blended learning to even support children who have to isolate. I've just gone through, says Salance, as a listener. This is Teresa in an entirely different context. She sees a sign up for a road closure from the 8th of January until March. She's wondering, is that around the main street? And finally, for now, means the eve of Little Christmas, says Shannon. Yes, it is, because Christmas night always refers to Christmas Eve night, not the night of Christmas Day. Now, I have a guest waiting online. Apologies for that. Final point from you, Owen.
Yeah, just on the message there from Teresa about the traffic in Salins. I saw those signs as well when I was coming into work this morning. It's from next Monday, the 10th of January, up until the start of March. And from what I understand, it's the junction there at Millbank where Lidl is. So you can essentially come from Salins as far as the Maxall service station or Marin's shop, and then you'll have to turn around. And from the Clane side, you can go as far as the traffic lights to Lidl, but you can't drive the whole way through the town. Now, I'm not entirely sure why that is. I know there's wastewater treatment upgrades going on in Salins as well. Whether they're linked, I'm not sure. It could be road resurfacing or whatever, but that road closes from the 10th of January.
All right, thanks for that, Owen. Later, we're going to be hearing, we discussed yesterday the situation where the HSE is using debt collectors to recoup money, fees from patients who've been diagnosed with cancer. We're continuing on with that discussion this morning with air traffic controller John Wall, who has stage 4 terminal prostate cancer, and indeed on numerous times on this programme over the last 2 years was campaigning, ultimately successfully, that medical cards be provided for those with a terminal illness of less than 2 years standing, if you get my drift. We'll also have other issues, including a listener who says that despite paying £4,000 a year for private health insurance, when her husband became ill, all private hospitals she contacted over the weekend were closed and he had to sit in a chair in Nurse General for 9 hours. That and other issues. But Noel Conniff is CEO of the Wind Energy Ireland organisation. They're based in Naas. Good morning, Noel.
Morning, Clem. How are you?
Thank you for standing by there for that. We're extremely busy this morning. Your industry is saying the changes to the national grid and the planning processes are required if Ireland is to meet the government's renewable energy targets. Of course, the Climate Action Plan, which we discussed when it emerged on this programme, has an ambitious goal of up to 80% of electricity being generated from renewables by 2030 in an effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions across the country. That's some target, is it not, Noel?
It is indeed, Clem, but thankfully we've a very good track record of success when it comes to renewable electricity here in Ireland. So maybe just to set the scene for you and your listeners, today we have a little over 4 gigawatts of onshore wind energy installed in Ireland. And over the last few years, that's been providing a substantial amount of our electricity. In 2020, just to give you an example, that's the last year where we've official figures, over 40% of our electricity actually came from renewable sources, and most of that came from onshore wind. And that makes us actually number one in the world for the amount of onshore wind energy that's provided as part of our electricity supply. So we do have a really good track record in delivering renewable electricity. So, and what we're saying now is that we need to effectively double that between now and 2030.
You're saying that, or the Climate Action Plan is saying, because Climate Action Plan is saying 80%, you're saying you're supplying 40%. So, right, we need 40% more by 2030. Now, how are we going to achieve that? Because I don't have to tell you, and I think you represent about 150 different members or businesses across the country which are engaged in the Irish wind industry, that the amount of concern and objection that go on to inshore, that is wind farming on land as opposed to wind farming offshore, is considerable in this country.
Sure. So to get to that 80% target, we're going to need to diversify our renewables that we have on the grid. So right now we have a lot of onshore wind energy. We're going to need more onshore wind energy, but we're also going to need things like offshore wind energy and solar generation to connect onto the grid over the next 10 years as well. Absolutely, there's going to be challenges in connecting that amount of different projects and different energy onto the grid. But increasingly, the polling is showing, Clem, that as the years go on and as people realise the challenge that climate action and that climate change will bring to our country and to our economy and our environment, that more and more people are supportive of measures to try and tackle that.
They are, Noel.
Electricity is definitely the best form of action that we can take.
Nobody's arguing that it's clean energy. It's also cheaper than fossil fuel alternatives. It's cheaper even than solar, is your view, I think. There are more than 300 wind farms across Ireland, as I understand it from reports. Now, the situation is that you know well, you're engaged in the industry, that people have concerns about these turbines, often 169 metres high, being placed on their land. That is to date where we've had considerable controversy. You're looking to double that practically, are you not? Or is there going to be much more focus on going offshore?
So to get to our target, we'll need to double the amount of onshore wind energy that we produce. But the good news, Clem, is that with improvements in things like turbine technology and different more efficient mechanisms of capturing wind energy, we don't need to double the amount of turbines or we don't need to double the amount of wind farms to double the amount of power. So the turbines today are much more efficient than the turbines that would have been installed, say, 20 years ago, for example. So we can install less turbines and still double the output. We'll also be absolutely, as you said, moving towards more offshore wind energy as well. So at the moment, we only have one quite small offshore wind farm off the coast of Wicklow in Arklow Bay. And over the next 10 years, we're hoping to develop about 7 to 10 offshore wind farms around the east and south and west coast of Ireland, which will help decarbonise our electricity supply. The important thing is that we actually do need everything. We need onshore wind, we need offshore wind, and we need solar, because the scale of the challenge is so enormous that we'll need to diversify and develop as much as possible. Just in relation to the concerns, we absolutely understand, we absolutely hear that, and it's something that we're always trying to improve and we're always trying to do better, is engage with communities earlier and much more often as we possibly can in the process whenever we're developing onshore or offshore wind energy. And I really encourage anyone out there with concerns to definitely do reach out to us or reach out to your local wind farm project if there is one in your area, to sit down and have a discussion with them if you do have concerns.
Yeah, people might say that, and I say this with respect to you, Noel, that the only reason you want to engage with people is to placate them, so that the planning process, which is quite detailed in this country and has been used extensively in relation to wind farms, and can delay the development of those wind farms for months and even years.
It would be very rare nowadays, Clem, for a wind farm that's in the early stages of design to not change once it goes through the community engagement process. So there is a substantial amount of community engagement that projects will go through. At the end of the day, people that are local to the area, they know the area much better than very often the developers. So it's getting that local knowledge really helps to better design the project so that it is more, say, environmentally friendly. It's more as socially conscious as possible to try and really minimise or mitigate any impact that it does have on the landscape or on people within the community. So it is a really important part of the process.
Okay.
The planning system that you mentioned, just to say that it is quite a transparent process, but it does take a considerable amount of time. So one of the things that we're really calling for is for more resources to be put into the planning process so that we do get quicker decisions, one way or the other, whether it's a positive or decision or a negative decision on the development. At least the community knows earlier, and at least the developer knows earlier.
All right, we know what's happened on land in this country, and we've been covering it for years here on the programme. In regards to wind farms, we know about people's concerns and shadow flicker and the hum off the turbines, and some people say, you know, they're a blight on the landscape and everything else. Be that as it may, it's been all well discussed by now. But I'm intrigued by the fact that, given that we're an island, and thank God we're surrounded by water, as the song used to say, that you're saying we have only one offshore wind-generating electrical facility in this country, when in a country like Denmark, for example, which is not an island, are producing up to 47% of offshore wind energy?
Yeah, so we were actually one of the first movers in the world, would you believe, for offshore wind when we built the Arklow wind farm in 2004. But we really stalled since then.
We've sat on our hands since, by the looks of it.
Policy didn't move. Supports to get the industry up and running didn't move, while at the same time our neighbours, like Denmark that you mentioned, and in Great Britain indeed, they've really progressed offshore wind energy. So we're really coming to it a bit late, but the good news is we are getting the right policies in place. The government are strongly backing the development of a planning system for offshore winds now, which we didn't have before this year, in fact. So we'll hopefully see the first new offshore wind farms in the water in about the next 5 years or
so.
And
could I ask you, in relation to, you said there you're planning, I think, between 7 and 10 offshore wind sites over the next 10 years. Have you identified the sites for those proposed wind farms offshore?
So our members would be developing, they're investigating a number of sites off the east, south and west coast. So there'll be a number of projects progressed initially off the east coast, and they'll all go into what's called a renewable auction, and they'll compete with one another so that the most competitive projects will be progressed. And then later in the decade, that development will also extend from the east coast to the south coast, and then ultimately to the west coast. Because as you mentioned, Clem, we have a huge offshore wind resource here in our country. And in a world where more and more of our economy and our businesses and our homes are electrifying, where we're moving towards electric vehicles, we're moving towards things like heat pumps, it's going to be really important that we have a large amount of electricity supply to help meet that growing electricity demand. And we're very lucky that we have a lot of offshore wind energy that can help us do that in the decades.
It's the one thing we can say in this country we're certainly not short of is wind. And given the huge fluctuations in electricity prices lately, not to mention, of course, the whole climate action plan, an alternative way has to be found. Many people would feel, though, that the emphasis should not be on the continuing spread of wind onshore, that we have the seas all around us, and definitely, as Noel is pointing out, the way to go is offshore. It has less of an impact on the environment. That's up for debate anyway. I'm just stating the different views in regards to that. You're based in Naas, CEO of Wind Energy Ireland, Noel Cunniff. Thank you indeed, Noel, for outlining that to us this morning. Happy New Year to you and good luck to you.
Thanks, Clem. Happy New Year to you too.
All right, we'll take a break there. Coming up, we'll be hearing from John Wall about that overall issue of the HSC continuing to use debt collectors to knock on the doors of cancer sufferers to collect fees.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Text or WhatsApp us 0833 97 97 97. Email studio at kfmradio.com, or you can call us on 045 898 999 and speak with Kira. Yesterday we had a considered discussion on the whole area of the HSE using debt collectors to knock on people's doors who've had cancer treatment and try to recoup the money owed. From a moral and ethical point of view, it was certainly been seriously questioned. We spoke with the Irish Cancer Society on that yesterday. And just to reiterate again, without a medical card or private health insurance, you must pay €80 for each chemotherapy or radiotherapy session, up to a maximum of €800 a year. Now, if you have the medical card, fine. If you have, maybe not so fine, because I'm only speaking from the perspective of what you have to pay here, not from the devastating diagnosis that you might have got. If you have health insurance and can afford it, fine. Although we'll speak with a listener, Geraldine, later on towards the end of the programme, that she has €4,000 a year private health insurance, but ended up sitting on a chair in Naas Hospital over the weekend, or her husband did, because everything seemed to be out of service. So, as we said yesterday, if you're a cancer patient, you might get a little letter amongst all the Christmas mail saying that you owe money, and that a debt collection company are looking for it on behalf of the HSE and will be calling to your door. Listeners will be familiar with John Wall. John is an air traffic controller at Shannon Airport, good Mayo man, actually, and John has been diagnosed with stage 4 terminal prostate cancer. Over a number of years, he conducted a very, very strong, prolific campaign with the respective ministers for health, whether it be Harris or Donnelly, in regards to the availability of medical cards for those diagnosed with terminal cancer. John Wall, good morning to you.
Very good morning to you, Tim, and to your listeners. Happy
great,
New Year.
Great to talk to you again, and Happy New Year to you and your family. How are you keeping, John?
Keeping well, thankfully, Tim. Keeping very well at the moment, and well, long may that continue.
So what do you make? That's very, very good news. I check in on you on Twitter on a regular basis to see how things are going. John, originally, just to remind listeners again, you were long campaigning specifically for what regarding medical cards?
Yeah, I suppose availability of medical cards to the terminally ill. Ultimately, I'd like medical cards available to all cancer patients, but that's certainly not the case at the moment. And we had to start somewhere, so I just wanted the eligibility criteria extended from what was a diagnosis of 12 months to now, if you have a diagnosis of 2 years or less, you have an automatic entitlement without a means test, and nor is it reviewed to a medical card, which is an invaluable piece of plastic, let me tell you from my own experience. It's absolutely invaluable.
As many other people would say. Now, given the escalating costs of private health insurance, given the impact on people's incomes for all sorts of things, not least the COVID pandemic and businesses closing, jobs being lost, people that previously might have been able to afford a medical card not being able to, or rather not being previously able to afford health insurance, no longer being able to do so. On average, John, cancer payments patients face a hike in expenses of over €750 a month.
They do. It's absolutely disgraceful. The cost, the financial implications of a cancer diagnosis are significant, as I found out myself, in that because I, for example, have a terminal prognosis, my credit rating is junk status. That means that I have no access to credit. So any bill that I receive, no matter what the size, you know, it has to be budgeted for. There's only a finite amount that wages can do. And we struggle from time to time as a result of my cancer diagnosis. So I cannot imagine those, we'll say, on less paid than myself. I have a very good wage, thankfully. But those on lesser incomes, I can't imagine the struggle that they must endure as a result of the ongoing cost of having a terminal, or indeed a cancer diagnosis, never mind a terminal diagnosis. And I think we must remember too, Ken, that successive governments, as part of their programme for governments, as part of their electoral promises, have promised a universal healthcare for all, and a medical card to all cancer patients is part of their programme for government. There's no sign of it, absolutely no sign of it. Quite the opposite when you hear of stories where debt collection agencies are now being employed to recoup debts from, in a lot of cases, people that are literally dying.
And John, what do you make of the morality of that? We have, for example, the HSE saying that they have a statutory responsibility to chase debts that are owed to them. The Department of Health then saying that from their perspective, the onus is on the HSE. The HSE saying the onus is on the Department of Health. But caught in the middle are those people are whose letters are popping through their letterboxes.
Yeah, it's typical what the department are blaming the HSE, and the HSE pointing fingers at the department. No one will accept responsibility. There's no accountability, no transparency. Ultimately, a decision was taken that it is appropriate to send debt collectors to a person at a time in their lives when they need compassion, they need help, and absolutely do not need something like this. But, as per usual, no one will take responsibility. The practice needs to cease, full stop. I understand that bills must be paid. That's not in question. But what is question is the morality of the methods that they're using to recoup the costs. And I believe within about 37, 38 days, that soon, that the debt has been passed on to a collection agency. That's absolutely unacceptable. It must stop. We talk, you know, about leading by example, or certainly we want to see those at the helm leading by example. And yet another story that broke during the last week or so was the chief executive of the HSE claiming a €20,000 a year car allowance, whilst at the same time having an army driver bringing him from one appointment to another. It's completely unacceptable, and it's about, as I said, transparency and accountability. And we're not seeing that at the moment. We're simply not seeing it. It's quite frankly, Clem, it's a disgrace.
All right. On that note, I don't think there'll be many people disagreeing with you on that. We reflected on the remuneration of the CEO of the HSE yesterday in the programme, being in excess of 400,000 a year, and that car allowance, which I think might have been up in the region of 28,000 and utilising. Now, in fairness to Paul Reid, he did explain why. The people can check that out. But also, given the real question behind this is, if anybody is diagnosed with gets a cancer diagnosis, the last thing they have on their mind is to be dodging their responsibilities in regards to pay or whatever else. It has to be predicated on the fact that people cannot afford the fees in question. And we're talking about life-changing, possibly terminal here. And as John said, previous governments, including the present, have talked about universal healthcare. And certainly in this case, whatever about expediting that, certainly in this case, I can't for a moment conceive how people who have been given that cancer diagnosis cannot be supplied with a medical card, either for the short term or the longer term, no matter what. But anyway, we just thought we'd get the views of John, who has campaigned so prolifically and obviously will continue as well. John, it's good to hear that you're in good form. We wish you absolutely the very best to you and your family. And sometime when I get back to the Banner, we'll definitely make that date to meet and chat. And also regards to our mutual good friend, Selbridge man, but of course, Newmarket native, Ger Kennelly.
Absolutely. Listen, thanks for giving airtime to this as well. It's very, very important. And the more noise that's made, as we found out, that's how things change and how this practice can cease. And we're not talking about down the line here. It needs to stop now. That's it. No questions asked.
Yeah. The idea of debt collectors knocking your door telling you we're only doing our job.
Kildare Today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Now, I'm afraid I have to be like a dog with a bone on this topic of debt collectors. Now, it's not that the collectors go into people's doors because somebody broke their arm or broke their leg or whatever else. Why can the HSE not engage directly with the people in question and say, right, you owe us for your chemotherapy or whatever else? Now, aside from the principle that I think if you do receive a diagnosis that signifies the end of your life, it should never come into it whether you can afford or not afford the treatment. And that medical card can be made available for those cases. It's not as if it's going to break us. We're spending billions on supporting businesses. Why can we not then spend the same amount supporting these unfortunate people who have received these cancer diagnoses? What is absolutely not acceptable is that the debt is turned over to a debt collecting agency which will knock on your door. We're here to collect the debt. You had chemotherapy recently. We want that money and we want it now. Like, or else what? You know? Before you just close the door on them and say, go away. Or else what? Are they going to seize property? Am I going to end up in court? Anyway, before we move on, a listener had contacted us over the last couple of days, Owen, in Derren Turin. Her house had been gutted with fire on Christmas Eve, and the problem hadn't been rectified. She'd been a tenant for 19 years with no defaults on rent, which is paid by direct debit, and she was trying to buy out her house and so on. And effectively, she had ended up homeless and living on a couch to couch at the moment. And her son, who was living with her, staying with friends at present, and other issues there. And she asked for our help. She emailed us and said, listen, things seem to happen when we raise them on the programme. Well, we try our best on behalf of listeners. I know you contacted Kildare County Council, and have we had an outcome on that?
Yeah, the main thing was, you know, just to ask the question of Kildare County Council, what was the plan? And without contact or without speaking specifically on this direct case, it was what happens in cases of houses being damaged by acts of nature, for example, fires or flooding or, you know, wind, whatever it might be. And in this case, it was a fire. Now, we didn't get a response from Kildare County Council, but the listener contacted me last night to say that following us getting on to them, that she had gotten a good outcome in the fact that she was staying in a B&B, and there was certain issues with that, that she worked in a care setting. She didn't want to be going from a care setting back into a house where she had to share amenities with other people and then go back to the hospitals, etc, etc. And she has now been sorted out with an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment in Enfield. I believe it's the owner of the B&B who has really took this under the wing and given her some help with herself and her son in getting into this apartment. Okay. She was very grateful, of course, with us getting on to Kildare County Council and moving this forward. But it's good to get that positive outcome from that situation.
Indeed. And we say it again, we're here to advocate on behalf of the people of Kildare, and we will continue to do so. And if you have issues of concern that you want to bring to our attention, always feel free to get in touch with us. We will keep your name and identity totally confidential if that is your wish. You can contact us through any of the sources we do. What else have you got on?
Yeah, well, shortly we'll be talking to another listener, actually, about that issue of private health insurance that you mentioned. Clem will be doing that in the next few moments. But first of all, Councillor Bill Clear of the Social Democrats on the Naas Municipal District. He joins me now. Bill, good morning to you once again.
Good morning, guys, and good morning, listeners. Thank you.
You're asking the public to help you, I suppose, catalogue all vacant shops, houses and land in Naas and Salins. You're saying that the aim is to either encourage the property owners to do something with the property, or failing that, put them on the derelict site register. It's something that, I suppose, irritates a lot of people when you're driving through a town or a village and you see properties and, you know, shops that once were are now boarded up. And this is something that has come to the fore now in Naas particularly.
Yeah, I suppose this kind of started. I was driving for work and I was going through a place called Ballinrobe in Galway, which has 50% of its properties, half its properties are derelict, you know. And at the same time, I was listening to a podcast by David McWilliams, and there was a guy in Cork who, and himself and his wife, a guy called Frank McDonald, during the pandemic went around Cork and identified 360 buildings that were derelict and worked with Cork County Council and got 200 of them back, right? So I decided I'd start in doing this in Naas, you know, and I need people's help, you know, because I can't. There's some places you just don't get, the back of estates or, you know, around the edge of the town. And the main street in Naas, there's 18 empty buildings, you know. Some of them are derelict, some of them are empty, you know. And we're constantly getting businesses contacting us looking for premises, you know. And, you know, and for a variety of reasons, they don't seem to be able to get it. And they either give up or they move to the outskirts. And this is the last thing they want. So what I'm trying to do is get a baseline figure for Naas and Salins. Just trying these two at first, you know, to manage it for myself. And I want to locate the building on a geodirectory, then we get the address, the air code, and get pictures. And then I want to, there's a vacancy officer in Kildare County Council, and to locate what the owner is, you know, and then there's carrot and stick, you know. So inform them what the grants are. There's a repair and lease scheme, which we can repair and lease it back to the council, and they'll take it over. And there's a new buy and renew grant scheme, Department of Housing, 20,000 to 30,000. You'll renovate it if it's over 12 months vacant. So they are this. And then there's the shopfront scheme, which, like, you can paint it, is available at the moment to paint the front of your premises just to make it look that bit better, you know. And I'm trying to get a baseline while they are, put them together, and then that's the carrot.
Okay, just briefly on this then, Bill. I know through the main street in Naas alone, you're saying there's 18 empty commercial buildings, which, you know, a lot of people would say that that's far too many for a town the size of Naas. If people want to get in touch with you and they want to help you out with this, locating the vacant properties in Naas and Salins, how can they do so?
Anywhere through my Facebook, Twitter, phone number is on my, it's on my connection, they can ring me. The just WhatsApp me a picture of where they are, just give me a general idea where they are so I can see them, and then I'll go through them all. And just to say, like, I mean, the Salons as well, you know, that most, it's owned by a small number of people, and you know, we need to engage with these, you know, and the stick is a vacancy tax, right? And they get taxed for derelict site tax, and then rates should be at 50%, and I'm aiming for that, an empty building that in these areas which there is a need. Okay. And you know, CMEX site, Intonace, that's been mentioned, the Tidy Towns, and we've just got to an IBAL first place, and you know, we will not win that with that CMEX site approaching the town if we don't do it. But get in contact with me, give me a picture of the place, you know, it's all confidential, and I would never divulge, and just tell me where they are, I'll go do it, and I'll do the rest, you know, and I'll chase it up, and that's the plan, try to do a pilot project in Nathan Salons. If there's anyone outside Nathan Salons wants to tell me once as well, please do.
Okay, Social Democrats councillor on the Naas Municipal District, Bill Clear. Thanks for that, Bill.
And indeed, Owen, on that, Owen, you and I will go through tomorrow. Bill brought a motion to a recent meeting regarding a vacant housing stock across the county. I have that report. We just don't have time to go into it. I had intended to do it today. But Bill elicited full details of the number of properties that are vacant and requiring refurbishment right across the five municipal district meetings. And we'll do that on tomorrow's program indeed. Now, thanks indeed, Bill Clear, for that one. We'll let you go, and just ahead of our next chat to Tommy and Trish Curry. How are you doing, lads? Up the banner and the magpies and the Taj and all of that over in Newbridge. Wish our neighbour Anne Brannigan a very happy birthday in Nullignamon. Let Kira off to a snug at 11. She deserves a break. We'll go to the snug with her. Clem, I worked in a secondary school in Dublin and was unable to go to work today due to COVID, says a listener. Got the email for cover today, and 23 teachers are absent out of 65 staff. Principal had made the decision late yesterday that the only way it could work is that second year stay at home until Friday. Before Christmas, we wanted to bring in parents had been great, but Department of Education is at fault. 2 year teaching degree worth €12,000 after 3 to 4 years. So we're so short of staff that if a teacher was absent and had a double period, then the school advised the parent to keep the children at home. If possible, graduates don't help. In regards to that message that came in about an hour ago, I'm trying to catch up on so much here. I am in County Kildare, says another listener. My son's school is not safe. Changing in the toilet after sports half. Half the class not wearing masks. No staff, all playing together in the yard. The safest place is at home for my son. It's not the teacher's fault. The schools should be closed until the end of January, says a teacher. KFM, we have a very arrogant government, says Mary, who are destroying the country. Good morning, Clem. If teachers, says Anne, are not in due to close contacts and there's no sub-teacher, can they not teach the class remotely by the timetable, especially for exam classes and students who are absent due to close contacts? They could log in and keep to the timetable. Yes, Anne, but it's never as good as in-person schooling and requires a huge amount of organisation. And finally, on the topic we discussed with John Wall and yesterday with the Irish Cancer Society, a listener says it's disgusting. It's the ordinary people that give most to cancer charities. Aside from whether they give most or not, is not the real issue. The real issue is that people with a life-changing diagnosis that could lead to the end of their life shouldn't have debt collectors coming to their doors. Mickey Meath says, what's people's problem? We all know fossil fuels will be a thing of the past. Wind farms aren't going to affect people's lives. Well, Mick, I'm afraid they do. Many people over the years have been on this programme talking about the noise from the turbines, the shadow flicker that goes on 24 hours a day, and other issues. Would you want one of those 169 metre turbines located adjacent to your property? If you do, good luck to you on that. And finally, for the minute, Clem, just advising anyone out buying couches that if they are defective in any way, it will take 5 months for replacement parts, according to areas I bought them. 5 weeks ago, you name a store there. I can't comment on that by identifying the store without having actually evidence for it. You say, I told them it was under warranty and I would bring them to the small claims court. I was told that the part would be in 5 months. Right, okay. What an absolute disgrace and shame on the country. One law for the rich, one for the poor. Cancer patients should have free treatment. And you go on and you reference all the bankers and politicians as well. I have to just tighten the messages because I need to move on. Geraldine O'Connor, good morning to you. And thank you for joining us. Tell us about your experience. Was it last weekend, Geraldine?
It was New Year's Eve.
What happened?
New Year's Eve. My husband became unwell and we had a phone consultation with our GP and then he requested to see him. So I brought him over and he said he would have to go into the hospital. And we said, fine. So he had the letter and I said, well, do you know what? I said, we'll ring the Hermitage. And this will, you know, rang the Hermitage. No, no, it's closed. It's only opened up until 5:30, 6 o'clock. And it's closed for the weekend. I said, we'll try. We tried the Black Rock Clinic. We tried the Beacon. We tried St. Francis in Mullingar. You name it. We tried it. All closed for the weekend. Every one of them closed. So we were left with no alternative but to go to our local hospital, which is Nice.
Now, you have health insurance.
We have private health insurance with Leia Healthcare, and we're paying almost, we're paying 3,900, I think, in 97, almost 4,000. So I said, no, I'm going to get on to Leia now and see about this. So, yes, or the following morning, when they were open on Tuesday, I rang Leia, and I asked them. So the lady rang me back, and I put my case to her, and she said, oh, yes, but it was after 6. I said, hold on, my point is, what have I got cover for? And she said, oh, well, it's there for, like, we'd say if you need a hip replacement and you want to go and see a specialist, you can go quickly and that. But I said, but if you get sick after 6 o'clock, no, well, naturally you can't do that. That's up to your local hospital. I said, hold on, the local hospital are not getting the money that I'm paying you. Oh, well, that's how it works, and all the other health insurance are the same. And she was right. I did check up, and they are all the same. Now, my point is, Clem, my husband is 77, please God, this year, and he had to sit on his, not even a normal plastic chair, a small plastic chair, for almost 13 hours in total.
At Nice, and, at Nice General, you mean?
At Nice. And when I was promised, I was promised that he would get a trolley, that they'd no beds, the nurse told me, and they haven't. They're run off their feet. They're run off their feet. And they had none, and he was promised a trolley, and he didn't. And I said at 10 o'clock that night, for God's sake, will you ask for the trolley? And he asked, and his response was, well, aren't you lucky you have a chair? Now, he has since yesterday evening, he did get a bed, and I've just have come from there now, dropping in clothes to him. You can't go in and see them, and, like, it's just ridiculous. I mean, and now, if somebody said to me, I said, well, why don't you take him out now and bring him to a private hospital. You're caught there, I said, as well. They won't see you because he's been in the public system that's covered with COVID. The place is walking with COVID. So therefore, I would have to take him out and test him for 3 days and make sure he's negative before. Why would you do that? My whole point is, I said to the lady in Leia, I said, you do know, I said, you're going to be paying €864 per day for either a plastic chair or a trolley. And she said to me, as quick as a flash, she said, oh, does he not have a medical card? I said, he does. Oh, no, well, he could use that. I said, he could, but he won't. Why should we? I said, the public health system should be getting the money that you're getting. You're not doing the job. It's, the whole thing is wrong, Clem. Why can't all these private health insurers come together and say, look, why would we all close on one weekend? Let one place stay open. No, because that would be common sense. They cannot do it. Our government have... they've let down the public hospitals dreadful. Once you get by A&E and Ace, it's great. Their treatment is perfect. But it's to get over that barrier. They cannot cope. The hospitals are bursting at the seams. And it's not just Ace. I'm sure it's every other hospital. But the point is, I met a man in the car park and he was crying, and I couldn't go over to him. And I just happened to say, are you okay? And he said, no, my wife is in there, and she's 82, and I haven't seen her in a week. And I said, oh, that's terrible. I know what it's like. And he said, and I'm kicking myself that I haven't private insurance. And I just said, don't kick yourself. And I told him the story. So I said, don't beat yourself up. It would have done you no good. So unless you get sick between 9 and 5, your health insurance is no good to you, Clem.
All right, Geraldine, we wish you, and indeed, particularly your husband, the very, very best in his recovery. But I think there you have it again, encompassing another situation of the state of our health service. That's not in any way an implicit or explicit criticism of the staff, as Geraldine says, run off their feet in every part of this country.
They're only doing what they can do, Clem. They're only doing. It'd be like you trying to go to a Brown Thomas's and shop with €50 and wanting something for €200. It can't be done. They're not getting the funding.
Okay.
They need the funding.
All right, Geraldine. Unfortunately, we're just out of time, but thank you for highlighting that again.
Thanks,
again,
Clem.
A reflection of what's going on in so many parts around the country. That's Geraldine O'Connor from Ballysacks, recounting her unfortunate experience, and we wish her, and particularly her husband, well in his recovery.